and welcome to the Pursuit of Health podcast, where we believe that healthcare belongs to everyone. I'm your host, Dr. Eric Fetke, a practicing pediatric cardiologist and educator. Together, we will explore the many facets of our unique American healthcare system, its strengths, its weaknesses, and what can be done to ensure that it meets its full potential to improve our lives. On each episode, we'll invite a special guest to help us on our journey. We'll learn about the various healthcare settings that these experts come from and the remarkable work they're doing to transform America's health. We'll take the best of what they have to offer so we can all reach for a better healthcare together. So join me now in our pursuit of health. On this episode of the Pursuit of Health podcast, I am thrilled to invite a guest who has an impressive resume in journalistic freedom, and she shares the background of both her and I being graduates of Princeton, and we would like to talk very importantly about a mutual colleague of ours from Princeton as well, this 2021 Nobel Peace Prize winner, Maria Ressa. And we will bring the discussion together in regards to why it is important for journalistic freedom to be a part of our consideration of our health as well. Professor Kathy Kiley is the Lee Hills Chair in Free Press Studies at the Missouri School of Journalism. She has a long career covering politics in Washington, D.C. She was also the editor for Bill Moyers and the Bloomberg Politics. She's covered Congress and national politics for USA Today, headed Washington boroughs for the Houston Post and the Arkansas Democratic Gazette. She was a White House correspondent for the New York Daily News and a general assignment reporter and Washington correspondent for the Pittsburgh Press. She holds a bachelor's degree from Princeton University, a master's degree from the American University, and was a Knight Fellow at Stanford University. It is with honor that we dedicate this episode to the 2021 Nobel Peace Prize winner, Maria Ressa. So please sit down and join us for this very timely discussion about freedom of the press and the impact on health and all of us. So welcome back, everyone, to the Pursuit of Health podcast. And as this project has once again proven, we are going into areas that I would not have expected initially when we first thought of the idea of delving into healthcare reform in this country and the effects that other nations may have and the interactions we have with each other across the globe. And we're going to add a twist to this. We're actually going to talk about journalism and the idea of freedom of speech in this regard and how this impacts our health as well. And to do this, I am honored and I will be honest with you all, a little bit taken aback and hope I do justice to inviting our guest, Professor Kathy Kiley. So welcome, Kathy, to the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me, Eric.
Thank you very much. This is reason I'm a little bit taken aback is Kathy Kiley is actually a veteran reporter, editor, and a professor of journalism. So we've got the roles switched here. I'm a very newbie to this and really never in thought this would go into the realm of news or journalism, but as with many things on social media, we're following the issues of the day. And I think this is why we wanted to do this episode. Kathy and I both share a background of being graduates of Princeton University. And one of our colleagues that the world has come to know lately is actually facing many issues that we were talking about. And we realized that the issues that she was facing abroad had relevance to our nation and to health. And the more we talked, the more we decided, Kathy, that we should have this conversation and include this on the podcast as relevant for those listening and hopefully also for our friend Maria Ressa. So again, welcome and thank you for joining us.
It's an important issue.
Yeah, and on that note, Kathy, Kylie, and Maria Ressa have both spent their lives dedicated to freedom of the press in many different ways. Kathy through Washington and through teaching and decades of advocating for the idea first embodied in our Constitution that freedom of speech and freedom of the press are something that are valued to us as a nation. And in that way, I really find that their journey and your journey, as well as Maria's, went from the notion that freedom of the press was a given. It was something that, you know, of course that exists in the United States. It's an essence, it's a value of our country. And to finding as the world has progressed and social media and digital media has progressed, that it actually is not something, as with much of our freedoms, that we should take for granted, and something that actually has been in many ways corrupted by those in power to try to erode that idea of freedom of the press. And that's what I wanted to talk about, and how that interacts or is part of our pursuit of maintaining our health as well. So on that note, I would really enjoy if you could tell our guests a bit about your background and how you believe and have gotten involved in, as a teacher and a career journalist, this notion of freedom in the press.
Well, I would say I did not start out my career as an advocate. I started out as a journalist. And of course, journalists, we generally don't think of ourselves as advocates. We think of ourselves as storytellers and people who inform our other citizens. We go to the meetings and dig through the records so you don't have to. And so I've always enjoyed that. I consider it a public service. And it was just something that suited my skill set. And I, you know, I've had a wonderful career. But as you noted, Eric, I think as Americans, we've always assumed that these types of freedoms to do this type of work were there and would always be there. Freedom of the press is enshrined in the First Amendment of our Constitution. So it really is an American value, but it's also a human right. I mean, I think the UN Charter recognizes it as a human right. And certainly our own country, that is one of the things that that we have propounded when we, in our foreign policy, when we have occupied other countries, we have insisted on freedom of the press. But as you said, I think it's endangered now, and it's endangered in part because of the proliferation of media. And it's kind of ironic because you would think the democratization of media would be a good thing. And in many ways it is. But I think what has happened is when you had sort of gatekeepers, meaning that you had to have a lot of money when I started in my career to have a printing press or a big antenna so that you could be a broadcaster or a publisher. That also meant you had a lot to lose. And of course, we have freedom of the press is not absolute. We have libel laws in this country. We have laws against slander and defamation. And so there was a real financial incentive to be accurate. And what has happened now with the proliferation of social media, when social media started back in the 90s, Congress, I think, and it was very well intentioned, protected this new media outlet, seeing it as a way to foster democracy and more speech. So they protected that from some of the libel laws that legacy media organizations have to abide by. And I think, sadly, we're seeing the results of that. Because if anybody can be a publisher, anybody can publish anything. And so I think that's why, you know, I'm not a mind reader, but I think that's why people like yourself who have real expertise in a field are finding yourselves becoming communicators because you need to push back the people who really have some expertise. If we don't speak out and say, this is what science shows us, or this is what the facts show us, you let the field be dominated by people who unfortunately are propagandists, conspiracy theorists, and, you know, there's money to be made in that, unfortunately, and so, and power to be grabbed. And so I think, you know, it's really changed the equation. And it's changed. It certainly forced me to think. It's one of the reasons I left the newsroom for the classroom, because I felt I wanted to help shape the next generation so they would have a democracy to live in like we did and have. And so they would have a free press like we have had. So I just think we're in a very different world. We're in a world that people, there won't be just a chapter in the history books. I mean, whole books are going to be written about the communications revolution. And I think we're at a tipping point. Is this going to work for humanity or against it?
It's interesting that you point out, you know, that again, that fact that here I am sitting as a physician in the media space, having this conversation with someone whose whole entire career is dedicated to journalism and with a hopeful background to the truth, and how even in my understanding, the Supreme Court has wrestled with this since the 70s in many ways, in terms of what does that First Amendment really mean? How much access to information does the press have? Do they have exclusive or privileged access above and beyond? I'm sure these are the discussions you're having in what I know you've called the laboratory, your classroom, to try to develop these ideas and get back to those fundamentals, which is essentially what I've been trying to do with this and some of my work with my students, getting back to those things that I believed made us exceptional as a free nation in healthcare and in journalism. And that idea that even the Supreme Court isn't quite sure how to parse out freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of the press, literally thrown in there in like three words, you know, in the First Amendment and the press. And it's like, okay, by the way, and really trying to figure out how important is that. And do they have, if I'm correct, more access to information coming from the government and those who we are supposed to represent us, or is that still limited in some way?
And you know, I think the freedom of the press really means not so much access to information. We certainly think everybody should have access to information in a democracy. But what it does mean is that the press has certain protections, I would say, and the access comes in terms of this. If I'm on Capitol Hill covering a hearing, I'm writing for a big audience. When I worked for USA Today, I had lots and lots of readers. And so if the hearing room was full, you might not get in as an individual, but I could get in as a member of the press because I was writing for this larger audience. And so there are privileges like that. I mean, getting into a courtroom, getting access, and the idea of that has always been, well, you're serving the public. You're here because you're serving a greater audience. But I think basically we want everybody to have access to information. It's just that most of us have very busy lives, and our jobs are not to be reporters. Our jobs are to be doctors or moms or dads or you know, plumbers, whatever the job is. And you don't have the time to sit through a congressional hearing or a city council meeting. And so the press is there. You know, I often, it's funny, now in the age of 24/7 news, you often will see the football coach will give a press conference or the president will give a press conference and they show it on television. I never watch that because it's a half an hour out of my life, right? And I'm waiting for some poor schlub who used to be me, who sits there for that half an hour and distills it down to the thing that'll take me 30 seconds or a minute to read, which is the most important points. And that's what journalists try to do. And for me, it's very convenient, right? It's I don't have to sit there and listen to the press conference or the hearing. So it's really more a matter of convenience, yes, but also making sure that everybody has access to that information so that you can make the kind of decisions we need to make to operate our democracy. Because in the end, we are the bosses of the democracy, and we can't make intelligent decisions unless we have good information.
And, you know, your explanation of that, and I much appreciate it, because it really clarifies for me some of the things that Maria Ressa, who you and I are doing this episode in honor of, and we will tell our audience more and more about Maria and why we're concerned and want to have this discussion. But I remember when I first, after we were in college, Maria and I were in the same classroom at Princeton, and she invited me just before I went to medical school to visit her in the Philippines. And as I did so, we actually were living in the same hometown as well. Our parents were. And as I went there, you could see that she dove into this idea as Aquino, Corazon Aquino, took over power, that she just naturally believed, Maria believed, that this needed to be documented and the people of the Philippines and perhaps the world needed to know an honest representation of what was going on. It wasn't even a question in her mind. She took it for granted that that's what should be done. What she didn't realize, I think, as I left back for the States and she said, you know, do you want to do a little more of this? And I said, well, I've got other commitments. She said, well, I'm going to stay and keep doing this. And I don't think what she realized was how much of a struggle she would have over the years to keep that honest representation of what was happening, as you said, be that eye on the ground. And then eventually she set up her own facilities in the government stations there, news stations. And I was actually around when she first stepped into those facilities. And just that journey, and tell us a little bit why, because that journey has become so difficult for all of you as journalists and for all of us on the receiving end of that kind of processed information, because as it's become more digitized and what Maria and I know thought was going to be a good thing, social media to get and reach more people, how that turned out to be something that had a downside to it.
Yeah, well, you know, I think if you think about the arc of Maria Ressa's career, she is a she came to the United States as a young woman, a young child, really, with her parents who were fleeing a very despotic government in the Philippines. And I have to say, I feel a really personal connection to this because my dad was a World War II veteran, and he fought in the Pacific Theater. And he helped liberate the Philippines. And so it's really painful to me to see, you know, my dad's memory, I think, desecrated by people who are trying to end democracy in the Philippines and end Maria's career and her freedom. And so I can feel my daddy's hand on my shoulder, you know, when I'm doing this work, because I think when Maria started, and I certainly experienced this a little bit in my career, too. It was a very hopeful time. I mean, democracy seemed to be blossoming everywhere. And the Aquino Revolution, you know, there are several things that motivate reporters. Sometimes we're watchdogs. Sometimes we want to entertain or delight. And sometimes we want to be just eyewitnesses to history.
I'll tell you, I was definitely tempted to stay at that moment. It was exciting.
Because
it was hard to leave.
And so Maria, after having grown up in the United States, and as you pointed out, going to college at Princeton, she grew up in New Jersey, went to college in New Jersey. She went back to the country her parents had fled. And she sensed that this was a turning point in history. And if you think about it, you know, in the 1980s, I covered the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989. And a very distinguished historian famously said, this is the end of history. You know, everybody thought, wow, this is the triumph of democracy and liberal democracy and democratic capitalism and blah, 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 you know, and all of this. And the despotism of the Soviet bloc was finally triumphed over. And look where we are now. You know, what hubris that was to think that. And I think certainly Maria thought she was covering a definitive turning point in her country's history when Cory Aquino took over from the Marcos regime. And of course, now we have Marcos's son as the president. So Maria spent her career as a reporter in Asia. She worked for CNN for many years, all across Asia, covered the rise of the Taliban, and which also uses social media to put with great effect to propagandize. She wrote about that, but she's a very optimistic person, as you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's one of the most irrepressible optimists I've ever met. And she decided to seize on this tool, social media, and use it for good. And so she's, in addition to being a great optimist and a wonderful journalist, she's the opposite of a cynic. You know, people tend to, the stereotype of journalists is cynical, and Marie is the opposite of that. And so she's an entrepreneur.
Right.
She starts that she worked for one of the biggest broadcasting stations. After CNN, she went to ABS, CBS, I believe is, I have, or CBN, mm-hmm. Which is the biggest broadcaster in the Philippines. And then did a startup, and her website, Rappler.com,
was Facebook based initially.
It was really Facebook based. Right. And it's it's funny because it's when you go onto the website, it's quite entertaining. And it's, there's a lot of pop culture there, but there's also a lot of investigative journalism. And Rappler started at the same time that the immediate past president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, started a war on drugs. And it turned out to be an extrajudicial war where people were just being rounded up and in some cases killed.
Right. There was no due process, which drove Maria nuts. Yes,
exactly.
Absolutely.
And for pointing that out, Maria became the victim of one of the most vicious, slanderous social media trolling campaigns that you can imagine. And that really was the canary in the mine shaft.
Right. And I was thinking exactly of that. They turned her tool, her hopeful, optimistic tool about her nation against her. They literally turned that as a weapon back at her. And I think it really probably opened up in her eyes in a way that, and I want to speak for her. I have talked a little bit with her about this, but I can just imagine how that affected her. And as you said, as the forces, and I'm going to quote you from a comment in the past, that the forces of darkness and intolerance are on the march, and journalists are the canaries in that mine shaft. And please explain to us how they're using and what that means. What is some of the concepts of misinformation and malinformation that are being using these tools against those who would use them for good?
Well, the problem is that on social media, what we have discovered is that repetition gives a false aura of truth. So, well, everybody's saying it, there must be something there. Everybody's saying that I shouldn't get vaccinated, right? So there must be something. Everybody's saying that I shouldn't wear masks. So there must be something. And everybody's saying that, you know, Maria is this or Maria is that. So there must be something.
There must be a kernel of truth somewhere to that.
Exactly. Right. And so it is that it is a psychological trope, that it's a heuristic that we reach for, a shortcut, a mental shortcut. We hear something enough and we think, there must be something there, right? But the fallacy of that is that social media and bot farms allow things to be repeated over and over and over again without there being any real credibility or even oftentimes real people behind it. And so we as human beings have to begin to understand how this new media works and how we can be manipulated by it. And it is a very, you know, and this applies, it is not just to journalists, it's to anybody in a position of authority. Certainly we've seen during the COVID outbreak, the pandemic, public health officials have been subject to the same type of treatment. And really, you know, many people are leaving their positions because it has been so brutal And so I think that's why this is really what, you know, what happened to Maria Ressa, and she said it herself, but it's absolutely true. These tactics can be used against anybody or for any purpose. And so I think it's very, very important for us all to educate ourselves about what is happening here. And as I say, there's money to be made out of it. So what happened to Maria is these lies began to be propagated.
This misinformation. So could you explain that to our audience? What does that mean? Right. The difference between misinformation and malinformation?
Yeah, I want to talk about those terms.
Yeah.
So, because they often get confused. And sorry, every journalist needs some coffee.
Well, I've got mine, and I'm going to be a little bit, we're going to do this here for Maria. There you go.
Very good. Your right. Princeton mug. I should have brought mine down.
There you go.
Anyway, but I'm embarrassed to tell you how many reunions it's been. We generally use two terms for this. Misinformation, which is really more benign, and disinformation.
Right.
What Maria has been subject to would be what I call disinformation. Misinformation is basically a fancy term for a mistake.
Right.
Or a something that has been information that's been provided based on incomplete data. Okay, right. So an example of that would be during the pandemic. At the beginning of COVID, remember, we were all told scrub everything, wipe down your used sanitizers on your grocery bags. Remember all of that,
right.
Don't worry about masks, right?
So something that was intentionally not meant to be mean or have a purpose, right?
Hey, Eric, it's going to rain tomorrow. You better take an umbrella. And the forecast change.
That was well meant.
I've made a mistake. It wasn't because I intentionally meant to make you schlep an umbrella when you didn't need to.
Right.
It's because there was a mistake. That is different. But what happens is in this very cynical, polarized age, people confuse one with the other. Disinformation is intentional. It is information that is planted to deceive or confuse,
right.
Or foment conflict. Like we see the Russians a lot of times we can see Russian bot farms coming in. And I can give you an example right from the University of Missouri and trying to foment conflict by planting these tweets and or things on social media that are meant to look like somebody's saying something nasty about somebody else. And the idea is they hope to foment conflict because the Russians don't have the military ability to defeat the United States. So the best way they can defeat the United States is to pit us against each other, right? So that's the Russian motivation. In the case of the Philippines, it is people who want to silence Maria Ressa. They don't like the reporting that Rappler is doing. So they try to discredit her and the news organization by spreading lies. Right. That is disinformation. Misinformation is a mistake. We make mistakes all the time. And if we're responsible communicators, we correct them. I mean, as soon as the CDC realized, this new virus that we don't know too much about is airborne, they said, mask up. But people are trying to say, and this is more disinformation, people who try to say, that was intentional. They were trying to fool you. And if you correct your mistake, you're a responsible person. Mm. We're not omniscient. Nobody is omniscient. There are people who know more than other people. You know a lot more about medicine than I do. So I would tend to trust your advice
as a source,
about what I
right.
could do over mine. And so I think this is what we in society have to sort of balance, that just because everybody can publish anything doesn't mean you should trust it all.
In medical literature or political literature or any source of information. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that subtlety or that confusion between disinformation and misinformation is not also unintentional. I think people are using right. that. They like say
Absolutely.
When they do something
That's
and they
kind
get caught.
That's a meta form of disinformation to try to cast a mistake as a deliberate attempt to undermine people. And it is a way of undermining credibility of institutions or authority figures to say, oh, that person's really out to get you.
Right.
You know, but I just ask people to think, why would the medical establishment be out to get you?
Right. What is the goal of that? And then it also works on the other flip side. When somebody intentionally is trying to go after and discredit someone for ulterior motives, and I would argue for power, to maintain power, when they get caught, then they say, oh, no, it was just some information. I was wrong. I'm sorry. And they kind of use it as a way out.
Yeah, this is one of my colleagues here at Mizzou gave me a great term for this, the liar's dividend. So that in a world where there's so much mistrust, liars can just get away with it for that reason. So, I mean, this is it's a very complicated problem, but I think I think the answer to this is not
right.
Censorship. I think the answer is education, and we as media consumers have to realize we have a lot more choices now. That's the good news. But the bad news is we really need to exercise our judgment in ways that, you know, we didn't have to before. We have to be a little more alert when we're consuming information.
And I think that's very important as a professor on your end, a teacher on my end as well, to teach our students. But here we are having a discussion that really we would hope that the general public, we can kind of help them understand. And I've tried to do that in many formats, which is to teach them, how do you separate these things out? I talk about sources, making sure that you know that the source is credible. Understand, as you mentioned, you know, well, why is a chef talking about vaccines and why is a doctor talking about food who's never cooked? He's always ordered out their entire lives. Does that make sense to you? Just ask some common sense questions. And then also look at, you know, is that information relevant to you on the receiving end or not? Or is somebody telling you it's relevant when you really wouldn't have thought so in the first place? So what's the goal of that? Why are they trying to put that information in your lap when you wouldn't have sought that out in the first place? What are they trying to do? Is there some manipulative factor here? And, yeah, you know, all these things that kind of, it is hard and it's difficult. And, but correct me if I'm wrong, that, you know, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee said this is important enough of an issue that we're going to recognize someone who's been spending their lives doing this because we think this is important to the whole world. I mean, it's not subtle what they're saying.
This is a really important point. And I actually had this conversation with somebody just yesterday who said, well, how do I know that Maria Ressa isn't guilty of these fake crimes that she's been accused of? And I said, look who's on her side. She won the Nobel Peace Prize. She won Princeton University's highest honor for an undergraduate alum.
This year,
She's been honored by the Committee to Protect Journalists, the National Press Club, Reporters Without Borders, and on and on and on. Who has Rodrigo Duterte or Ferdinand Marcos Jr. been honored by? And what would Maria's motivation be to try to influence you versus theirs? The other thing that I think is very, very important, and I think you're absolutely right. The Nobel Peace Prize went to Maria Ressa because people who are smart understand how people have been victimized by this. And I think this is really important, not just for journalists, not just for public figures, but for parents. I mean, you need to know that your kids can be treated like this on the internet, and you need to be able to help them do what Maria Ressa did, which is speak out. Because when you are bullied and trolled on the internet in the way she was, it is a very embarrassing, humiliating experience.
It's very personal.
And the idea, and it is absolutely very personal. And I remember the first time I talked to her about this years ago, and she was almost hesitant to show me some of the stuff that she had been targeted with, because it was so personal, so embarrassing. People who are crazy know exactly what buttons to push.
Yeah.
And And so what happens is the idea behind this kind of treatment is to isolate the victim and make that victim feel like he or she is alone. And that, you know, and this is what gaslighting is, to this unrealistic idea that you're, you know, and you've been ostracized and everybody hates you and, you know, you're ugly or you're terrible or whatever it is. And the thing that Maria did that I think won her the Nobel Prize is she had the courage to speak out.
Yeah. Right.
She had the courage to say what was happening and to call this out. And I think
at a high risk, a very high risk, which many of us, the price of freedom. Right. Right.
But I think the reason she got that Nobel Prize is that the Nobel Prize Committee understood the courage involved in that, but also understood the impact that this could have on all of us.
Yeah.
That this is the kind of courage we have to have. And it's also the kind of analytical ability that she turned. She didn't stay passive. She got out there and did her reporting and found out what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
And she learned what was going on. And we can talk a little bit more about this, but I think one of the things that she uncovered or helped to make very clear was the extent to which we are all vulnerable to manipulation when we are using social media or the internet, period. Mm-hmm. Because we increasingly live in a cashless economy. And we increasingly live on the internet. And when we use a credit card or when we go online, we are leaving a trail of data about us that makes it possible to pigeonhole us and send us down these rabbit holes where you only hear things that you already agree with. And so you're not hearing any other point of view. And so we can talk more about that, but I think that's one of the important things. So people who don't like this or that are only going to hear from people they already agree with. And that drives polarization and it drives confirmation bias and it drives hate, really.
I think, you know, the two comments on that, and again, that really sheds a lot of light on what she's going through and the relevance of her work and struggle to maintain that honesty in information despite all the odds. And that's that the Nobel Peace Prize committee realized that that bullying and that using of that tool was more effective if it was against one person. So I think it's important to realize that they then said, well, they will put two people in up for this prize, Dmitry Muratov as well, from Russia, and say it's not just one person, it's not just Maria. There are others out there too, and therefore, we're upping the ante. It's not just one person you can bully. Try to do it to multiple people and to the whole field of journalism, and on and on and on. It's just all of a sudden it's turning it around. And as I've said to my students many times, and they've now made a T-shirt for me on this, it's not the problem; it's the point. Maria said, what's this problem? What's going on here? What is it? She turned it around. She became an expert. When she speaks, it sounds like she has, you know, an IT degree because all of a sudden she had to learn how to use this thing that we used against her. And she worked her tail off, it sounds like, to learn about this. So she said, that's not the problem. They're using this against me. I'll figure out how to not let them do that. And I'm doing it not for me, which is even more amazing. That's probably why she also is recognized. I'm doing it for everyone.
Well, the interesting thing about the Nobel Prize, last year's Nobel Peace Prize, going to Maria Ressa and Dmitry Muratov, they really represent, the two of those people represent old-fashioned censorship and the new censorship, right? Because Dmitry Muratov is from Russia. And, you know, Vladimir Putin is using the classic, you know, Soviet era tactics of cracking down on people and arresting people and censorship. There's a new way of mind control and manipulation that the internet has made possible. And that is disinformation by a surfeit of bad information. And that is what Maria Ressa represents. So both of these are threats to democracy, and both of these are threats, really, you know, to bring this around full circle, to public health,
right?
Because at public mental health, certainly that, you know, this is what I'm talking about with the vulnerability, particularly of our young people, but even older people who, you know, we're living in a very susceptible world.
Yes.
And, you know, and people look at the media and they confuse social media with legacy media. So they think everything on Facebook is like Walter Cronkite delivered it. No, you know, crazy cousin Vinny's post is not the same as, you know, your local newspaper. So I think people need to be educated to this. But both of these are major threats to both our mental health and then, you know, as we saw during the pandemic, our physical health, because there's a lot of snake oil salesmen out there who are using the internet in ways that are not good for people.
Well, Maria is actually not stopped after receiving the prize. Obviously, she's doing her work at Rappler, but to that note, in October, now, currently, she's joined the Council of Responsible Social Media to address this issue of how this impacts mental and public health. As the joining issue one, which is, you know, worked in this area in many ways in voter rights and other issues, and to address the negative mental, civic, and public health impacts of social media in the United States. So she's working at home and in the Philippines on these issues. It's just nonstop.
This is her raison d'etre now. And, she is really a crusader, and I think anybody who's, you know, any technology, and I think this is where Maria's coming from, any technology can be used for the good or the bad. You know, you can use a gun to get tonight's dinner, or you can use it to shoot up a school. You can use TNT to blow a hole in a mountain and make it a lot easier to get from point A to point B, especially in the winter. Or you can use it to blow up a federal building. You can use atomic energy to blow up a city or to power it, you know, and it's the same with the internet. You know, we can use this and we have used it for a tremendous good. We are using the internet right now for what I hope is a good, but it also can be used for the bad. And who is it on? It's on us. You know, what kind of how are we as individuals going to use it? How are we as citizens of a democracy going to advise our policymakers about regulating it? These are all decisions that have to be debated. And when you have somebody as smart and as dedicated as Maria Ressa on the case, you know, I think I think things are hopeful. I think the question is, can she stay on the case? Because her own government seems to be on the verge of wanting to put her in jail.
Right.
And this is what is so scary right now.
And that's why you and I said, let's talk about this and let everybody hear this conversation. It is as basic as that, that her work here abroad and, as the world said, nationally on this issue, that it's very complex. We could spend, and I probably will spend, several future episodes that are already in the bucket to talk to people about how this misinformation, disinformation created this disastrous response to the COVID pandemic, where the nation with the most resources, human and physical resources, had the worst outcomes in the world when it came to this pandemic. And it was directly tied, and we'll do that in the future, to this.
Because we have the best internet.
Right.
Yeah. Or close to.
Right.
Yeah. And best internet penetration, let's put it that way.
Right. And how that confused everyone, and for what purposes, and what was the gain on that, and all this idea that we're touching on just on the surface. But we have a champion out there, someone who the world has said, you know, we trust and has always been doing it for the right reason. As you mentioned, her credibility is backed up by what I think is the most important thing in credibility, her history, her legacy, what she's done. Look at that, as you mentioned, and compare that. And so why it's important to back up someone like that and then not let her be silenced, not have that canary in the coal mine be snuffed out, which is the concern that you have. I know you've written about this. We've talked about this. It's been mentioned in many of the forums that Maria has gone to. How do people not let this, which we can talk more about the details of how it does this, but, you know, create this silence that creates further disasters in the future, both medically, civically, public health, emotionally, it really basically erodes society. Why is it important that we let her keep singing?
Yeah, what she was being criticized for, the reason the government didn't like her, is that she was, what was she demanding? Due process. Due process for people who are unpopular, suspected drug dealers. But how many, you know, generally we decide, well, you arrest somebody, but they might be guilty, they might not. We've seen a lot of cases where people who are charged aren't necessarily guilty. All she was saying was, could we have a trial? Could we have a jury trial? Mm-hmm. And so for some reason, people didn't want that. And again, you know, you can extend this to your field. I mean, should we have a trial? There's a lot of reasons governments don't want to have vaccines. They're expensive. Public health is expensive. And if you can convince people they don't need it, it's a net plus for your budget. So I'm just saying that a free press is a check on power. And we know that power needs to be checked. Right. And in Maria's case, that's what she was trying to do. And it's very possible that press freedom advocates who are following her case think it's very possible she could be ordered to jail next month.
Right.
And it's, you know, this is incredible.
That's why you and I have raised the alarm bell. You raised the alarm bell, and I tried to respond to it, and I appreciate you doing so when you reached out to many of us. And this is why we decided to have this conversation, because we believe there's an urgency to this matter.
Yes, absolutely. There are more than 20 cases that have been filed by the government of the Philippines against either Maria Ressa, Rappler, the news organization she founded, or employees of that organization. And again, this is a new form of censorship. It is censorship by legal fee, because the Duterte government pulled the license of the nation's largest TV broadcaster. It would be as if the federal government here pulled the license of, say, NBC or Fox or CNN, a big broadcaster, and just said, "Well, you can't be on the air anymore."
Right.
But they couldn't do
that. Which Putin recently tried to do.
They can't do that. There's no license for a print publication. So what they are trying to do instead is file so many legal cases that it will tie down the newspaper in legal fees, or the news organization, I should say. It's an online organization, but and bankrupt it. Okay. And so but those cases, one of those cases has been decided against Maria by an appeals court. And it's going to the Supreme Court of the Philippines now. And the Philippine Supreme Court...
October 25th, if I'm correct.
Yeah, and it could decide within 5 days without even hearing oral arguments, make a summary judgment. So that's what we're concerned about. We are concerned that somebody who has been really is lauded across the world for the work she has done for press freedom, and who has won a Nobel Peace Prize, may be incarcerated.
Right. And the impacts for us and all of us, because the health impacts. And again, if people want to think about it, because this misinformation, disinformation kind of leads people. And you've talked about this where, you know, people go, well, you know, if I support her and I was wrong, maybe. And what if she did do something wrong? You know, and then am I now kind of complicit in supporting something that was wrong? Look at the sources of the people and the institutions that we have trusted for generations that have come out and said that this is dangerous, what they're doing here, and raise the alarm bell as you have. And don't all of a sudden decide to throw away their legacy, whether it's Columbia or these other institutions as your own, who have said, no, we think they're doing this on person is dangerous. Trust us. And the question, that's a whole nother discussion. Why wouldn't you trust us to tell you this is an alarm bell? And somehow this disinformation is being used to create distrust in the institutions that are supporting people like Maria. It's kind of a vicious cycle. And at some point, we've got to unwind this.
The thing is, when we put out a call for people from Princeton, where Maria is an alum, to sign a letter, expressing support for her and asking the government of the Philippines to basically call off the dogs. We now have more than 600 people who are part of that list. And one of the people, and that group is ideologically extremely diverse. We have people who have served in Democratic administrations. We have members of Congress. We have people who served in the administration, the Bush administration. We have people who have served for Clinton and Obama. And the person who now has passed on, but one of the people who signed that letter before he died was George Shultz, who served as Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan. So I think it's really important for people to understand that this is not a Republican issue, a Democratic issue. It is not an ideological issue. People who
It's not a liberal conservative, you know, vaccine versus anti-vaccine. It's more than that. It's a much higher level.
Yeah, this is about what are the institutions we're going to have? Are we going to have a democracy? Are we going to have, because all of the tactics that have been used against Maria, we can see migrating to other countries, including our own. And so we really need to, Maria's mantra is hold the line. And we really need to hold the line. We really need to say, stop taking for granted the democracy that we grew up in and the freedoms that we've grown up enjoying, and understand that this is a participatory sport. You don't just sit by the sidelines and watch, because if you do, you know, it's use it or lose it. And we are really in danger, I think globally, but even in this country, we are really in danger of losing a lot of the things we've taken for granted. So I would just say, you know, Maria Ressa to me is like a giant alarm clock for all of us who care about freedom and care about having good information that allow us to pursue the things we love, whether it's the careers we love, whether it's the things we want for our kids, whether it's health. You know, I mean, we need to have good information and a free flow of accurate, reliable information in order to make democracy work and in order to make our lives work. We take it for granted that we can look things up and the information will be reliable. Well, we can't take it for granted anymore.
It harks back to the essence of the podcast, which we kind of fell into the name Pursuit of Health, which obviously is, as I mentioned, a hark back to our Declaration of Independence, Pursuit of Life, Liberty, and Happiness. And how can that inalienable right be done if we're not healthy? None of that can occur. And then the Constitution steps in, correct me, because you're the professor on this, but correct me as a citizen, but I see the Constitution in the First Amendment says, we're going to back that up. We're going to give some teeth to that. We're going to make sure that that is the first thing we write about. Freedom of religion, speech, and press. And they didn't do that, obviously, unintentionally. So I hope we're not questioning that fundamental institution, our Constitution itself, because then they've really won.
I hope we're not.
Right.
But I have to say, I'm not a doctor, but I feel like our democracy is ailing, and it has a virus.
Right.
And it has a
good analogy.
Virus of disinformation. And this is a global pandemic that is just as dangerous, maybe more so, than the pandemic we've been living through of COVID. And, you know, it is a virus just like COVID that morphed in a way, came out of something new, the internet, and is just as COVID did, presenting us with some new challenges.
Internationally, worldwide.
Absolutely.
This
globally.
Is right. Globally. These are global issues.
You know, I mean, I was in Africa helping to train journalists earlier this year, and I had to tell them, I said, you know, I really would love to tell you that we have all the answers in the United States, but all we've really done is make the mistakes before you did, because we have the communications infrastructure to do that. And I said, I'm not here looking to teach you necessarily. I'm here looking for allies. I think globally, we're in a world war. Thank God in our part of the world, the bullets aren't flying. I hope they never do, but we are in a world war.
Well, they do in another way. That's another session we've talked about, our own gun violence. Yes. All right.
And that is fomented by hate speech.
Right.
And, you know, this is the other thing. Hate sells. I sometimes, when I make presentations about this, some of your readers who are of an older vintage like me will remember this. But, you know, there was this great cartoon character called Pogo, and Pogo looks in a mirror, and there's a great caption. Pogo's looking he's a little schlubby figure, and he looks in the mirror, and the caption is, "We have met the enemy, and it is us." And the internet plays to our confirmation bias. It plays to our desire for an enemy. It plays to our desire to get revved up and excited. And the thing that promotes engagement on the internet, I mean, internet providers, the news is not free, okay? There's no free lunch. I think we can all agree on that. But my students, you say, oh, why should I read the newspaper? You know, I can get it for free online. Well, you know, you have to pay for somebody's paying for the broadband. It's usually mom and dad and the computer. But the real payment is the data about yourself that you are feeding into that computer. And based on, you know, there are these very sophisticated marketing tools that based on who you like, what you're buying, what you're shopping for, where you live, how old you are, what magazines you subscribe to, there are all kinds of data points that are being used to pigeonhole you into an ideological and class and sociological box that then enables people to market to you. Guess what? Facebook doesn't make money when you're not on Facebook. Google doesn't make money when you're not on Facebook. So what are the chances that Google and Facebook are going to serve you up something that they know because of their algorithms might cause you to feel uncomfortable?
Yeah. And Maria has directly addressed that by literally sitting down with Mark Zuckerberg. This is the stuff she's doing. To say, look, Mark, Mr. Zuckerberg, we're not here to, you know, say that you perhaps didn't have the best intentions yourself at the beginning, just like Maria did. But, you know, there are some mistakes we're making. Let's look at these together. Let's work on these. This is what she's doing.
Exactly.
And at all levels. And it's important for all of us to realize that this national, global pandemic on a health level, with the virus and this of the misinformation, as we've alluded to, are tied together. And Maria is the advocate, that optimist who is turning around to this beast and saying, you will not divide us. We will hold the line. I'm thinking of Lord of the Rings. You shall not pass, you know, when the beast comes and says, you know, for those people who are Lord of the Ring fans, including my wife, you know, this is the line we will hold, because you thought you could divide us. Thought you could take down the world and the freedom and the democracy that's based on our ability to hold together regardless of our ideologies. Do not use this tool against us. We will not let you do that. This is why, for health at all levels, we need to protect Maria.
100%. And this is a person who, in an era when hate is really being exploited and fomented, this is a person who has had nothing but optimism and compassion. You know, it would be very easy for Maria to just caricature Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, but instead she reaches out and tries to work with those people. That is a model for what all of us should do with people who disagree with us, or we feel some way or another have hurt us. This is the way, you know, our country of 330 plus million people, we cannot survive. One thing I know from having covered the federal government is we cannot survive unless we compromise. Our whole system is built to foster compromise. And Maria is just a role model for all of us And so I agree with you. I think it is her fight has to be our fight, because it is our fight.
And how do we have people look more into this information? We'll provide them. I'd like to provide a link to her talk that she gave at Princeton this year. I think she summarized a lot of these things very well when she
Great
did
talk,
that.
Yes.
And very clear for all of us as an introduction. And hopefully you'll provide some access. I know you want to provide some access for how people can advocate for Maria, that the Americans and perhaps anybody else who's listening, I have colleagues in South Africa and other areas as well, listening to this podcast, people who will say, you know, look, we are aware of what you're trying to do. Our eyes are on you on behalf of Maria. How can they reach out to their representatives to do this?
Absolutely. I think reaching out to your elected representatives is incredibly important. I will say one thing, members of Congress, and of course, the equivalent in other countries, are very responsive to their constituents. So what I recommend here in the United States is to go on to house.gov. That's an easy thing to remember, house.gov. And it will take you to a page where there's a lot of information about the House of Representatives. You can look up your representative by name, or if you don't know who represents you, which is sometimes complicated because the districts are not obvious. There's a box in the upper hand corner where if you enter your zip code, it will find your representative for you. It'll ask oftentimes for zip code plus four. If you don't know the four number suffix that the mailman likes us to use, you can go to USPS.com. That stands for United States Postal Service.com. And there's a zip code lookup there. So it'll give you the whole number. And go to the representative's website. And all representatives now, I recommend email because snail mail takes a really long time. It has to be screened to go to Congress. But you could even find your on that website, your member, your House member's local office, and you could walk by or carry a letter there. There are lots of ways to reach out, but there is an email form on all of the members' websites. Just look for the contact button on the website, and you can reach out and very easily tell your representatives and tell your senators, who I'm going to tell you how to reach them in a minute, that you would like them to contact the Philippine ambassador in Washington and tell him they are concerned about this case and they are watching this case. The United States is a very important ally of the Philippines. The Philippines gets a lot of money and defense from the United States. If our members of Congress tell the ambassador that they do not want to see Maria Ressa, a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, put in jail, it can have a very important impact. The Philippines has a new president. I think it's important for him to know what behavior will be rewarded by the United States and what will not. To reach your senators, easy, even easier, U.S. Senate, it's just senate.gov. And there you will find a site for the U.S. Senate, and there is a way you can look up senators, again, by their name or by their state. You can just enter your state, and you will get the website. There'll be a link to the websites of your two senators. So doesn't take very long. Again, there's a contact form. You'll see addresses for the members' Washington office and their local offices. So if there's a local office near you, stop by. They're your representatives. They work for you. So use your voice to support somebody who really is supporting us by the fight she's waging. And I think if enough of us do it, it'll have a really profound impact.
And I really, appreciate the information. And I want people to stress the urgency and the timeliness of this. October 25th is when a summary judgment, which basically means that they'll leave it in the hands of the judge as to whether or not.
When, let me just correct that. It's when Maria will file.
Will file.
But then the clock starts ticking on 5 days. I mean, we hope the court will take more time than 5 days, but there is that possibility that the court could just issue a summary judgment without any more briefs or oral arguments. So that's the big concern. We want to make sure that that doesn't happen.
Right. And there may be, again, some hidden agenda of that court in particular. We don't know. They may believe they're doing the right thing, but we want them to hear, you know, our concerns because of the things we've talked about here. And I think the history that you mentioned, I think it's important for all Americans to tie in the very important history you mentioned about your father, my father, in the armed services as well, and our relationship with the Philippines. We saw the relationship and built that relationship and wanted the Philippines to be a free nation. And we did so in the defense of democracy, which meant the defense of our Constitution, which meant the defense of this ability to have free speech and a press. And our own family sacrificed their lives and those of their friends in a generation before us for this purpose. Maria took up that mantle. She did not have to go back. I have many colleagues of mine in the Philippines who are Filipino who never went back after they left. After Maria's family left, many of them stayed. Maria went back, and she did it for all the right reasons. And it's our time to support her on why she went back. This is where we are. This is the line. This is the point in history where we say, and this is, I'm not overstating this. This is tied to why our parents and a generation before us fought. This is directly linked to that. This is the time for all of us to say, do we believe in what they stood for and the mantle that she is carrying onward for that?
Pick up a pen now so you don't have to pick up a gun later.
All right. And hopefully much more powerful. Well, I thank you very much for sharing your experience on this, the reason it's relevant to us at all levels of health, and why it's important that we support Maria so that we can continue to have these kind of conversations for many, many years to come, because these are the things that are at risk if we don't support her at this time. So I really thank Professor Kylie for joining us today. Kathy, it's been an honor to share this moment with you, and we all cross our fingers that people will step up and that others will listen.
Thanks, Eric, and thanks to your listeners for taking the time out of their day to listen, because it is important for all of us.
All right, and this will be aired right away so that everybody can get active. And as we say, it's one thing to talk, it's another thing to walk. Once again, we have delved into an area of our society whose impact on healthcare may not have been initially as obvious to all of us, including myself. But I hope that you all now understand why the pursuit of health, the concept behind this podcast, requires that it be linked very strongly to the pursuit and the support of democracy, and how that is tied into freedom of speech and freedom of press. I believe that our guest, Professor Kathy Kylie, made a very good argument about why these two are inseparable. And we would also like to make sure that everybody supports our colleague, Maria Ressa, who is in the Philippines right now and facing judgment by those who would be threatened by what she stands for, and why this canary in the coal mine, this Nobel Peace Prize winner, needs to be able to continue to sing loudly for all our sakes, for our civic, public, and our biologic health, why this is important. Again, we will place the links on how you can press your representatives locally and nationally in support of Maria Ressa. That will be provided on our descriptions, and we look forward to your comments on this episode and all of our episodes, but we believe this one is timely and very important. You can reach us at Dr. Fetke MD on Facebook and Instagram. That's DrFetkeMD on Facebook and Instagram, and on our website, drfetkemd.com. Until next time, I wish you well in all your pursuits.